Good morning. I also would like to apologize for the delays. And again, for those of you who didn't hear it, we weren't really trying to play favorites and pulling people out of the line. But if we knew personally someone in the line, we felt like it would expedite pulling those people out and getting the line shortened and getting everybody in. So we actually made it pretty close to on time, as close as lawyers ever get to on time, I think. The court will be out in about 4 or 5 minutes to begin argument. I know that if you were wanded in, you were told this, but I would please remember to turn off your cell phones and pagers, or turn them to something that the court won't hear in the middle of argument. I remembered to turn mine off, so please turn those off. Most of you, I think, picked up a brochure on the way in. If you didn't, it's a little late to get up and do it now, but they are on this chair. If you didn't get one on your way in and you want a memento of the occasion, you can pick one up on your way out. It has a short summary of the case for this morning and a little bit about the court and a picture of each of the judges on the court. And lastly, if you need to leave the room for some reason during argument, please do so quietly, as inconspicuously as you can in a room this size. And just be aware, though, that in order to come back in, you'll have to be wanded back in. So I would really encourage that if you do have to leave, rather than trying to come back in this room, you might just want to go to the TV, AV monitor room, and watch the rest of the argument from there. And unless anyone has any questions or comments, the court will be out shortly to begin argument. Thank you.
God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has one oral argument for submission in this unique venue. That case is Texas Workers' Compensation Commission versus Patient Advocates of Texas and Alan J. Merle. It's from Travis County and the 3rd Appellate Judicial District. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument, and the petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We are ready to hear arguments from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Dewey Hellenkamp, Mr. Pete Schenken will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Hellenkamp will open the first 10 minutes. Mr. Hellenkamp will present rebuttal.
May it please the court. Petitioner and cross-respondent, Texas Workers' Compensation Commission, respectfully ask that at the conclusion of this proceeding, the court do two things with regard to this case. The first thing we ask the court to do is affirm that portion of the Court of Appeals opinion which upheld the validity of the 1996 medical fee guideline and one of the dispute and audit rules, the so-called one-year statute of limitations. Second, we ask that the court reverse and render that portion of the Court of Appeals opinion which held that the remainder of the so-called dispute and audit rules constituted an improper delegation of governmental power to a private entity without sufficient standards in violation of the Bollweevil standards and this court's previous decision. The commission would begin by respectfully reminding the court or informing the court the workers' compensation system is a complicated but carefully crafted scheme established by the legislature to provide for the care for injured workers of compensable injuries. There are three components or three protagonists in the system. The first is the injured worker. The second is the medical provider or health care provider who treats the injury. The third is the insurance carrier or other third-party payor who pays the bill. This case arises out of a challenge, as you know, to several of the commission's rules. I'm going to reserve most of my discussion for the validity of the medical fee guideline and the one-year rule to the rebuttal portion and spend most of the time, subject, of course, to the court's questions, dealing with why the Court of Appeals erred in holding that the dispute and audit rules constitute an improper delegation of governmental authority. If you look at the workers' compensation statute, which, as I mentioned, is a carefully crafted legislation or statute, you'll see, first off, the Commission has broad authority to adopt those rules necessary for the implementation and the enforcement of the Act. This is found in Section 402.061 of the Texas Labor Code, which is, in fact, the Workers' Compensation Act. One of the key things that the Court of Appeals missed in arriving at its decision that there was an improper boll-weevil delegation, and it never discussed the specific statutory provision in Section 408.027. This provision of the Labor Code is very important because it is the statutory recognition that insurance carriers and other third-party payors shall pay an appropriate bill unless they choose to audit that bill to determine whether the amount of payment is appropriate or the authorization for payment is appropriate. And what that means, in short, members of the court, is just two things. Insurance carriers and other third-party payors have an obligation and a recognition by the legislature that they must, in fact, review and audit bills provided by health care providers to determine, is the fee that is being charged proper? Has the health care provider, for example, improperly unbundled specific procedures? Have they charged an amount in excess of the maximum allowable reimbursement set by commission rule, such as the medical fee guideline? Any number of other things that might be involved with a fee dispute. The second part of that statutory recognition of carrier authority is the carrier's responsibility to ensure that the medical care which has been provided is in fact reasonably necessary for the injured worker. We do not disagree with patient advocates that an injured worker is entitled to all medical care reasonably necessary for a compensable injury. But the issue here, or one of the sub-issues, is simply whether or not medical care in a specific instance is in fact required.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, Justice Snyder.
Why wouldn't, just the very idea, just kind of slaps you in the face, why would the legislature be allowed to have an insurance company come and go through all my records and basically conduct a search and seizure almost, and maybe not a seizure, but at least a search?
Well, first off, I must respectfully disagree with the characterization. Certainly that's how Pat would characterize what happened. But the answer to your question is the legislature recognizes that the Workers' Compensation Commission performs the oversight or referee role in this process. The commission simply is not staffed nor funded to be that sort of a referee.
Well, let's say that we didn't staff the Department of Public Safety. Would that be a good reason to, say, allow the Salvation Army to go conduct searches or stop speeders?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think the difference is that the workers' compensation system, remember, members of the court, is nothing more or less than a creature of statute. It is created by the legislature to provide the framework and the scheme of statutory provisions augmented by commission rules to govern the provision of health care and the payment for that health care. And it's a totally different situation, I think, Justice Snyder, than the DPS situation. But more importantly,
But isn't that the reason, that the problem with the rules, as I say they're claiming them, is that it puts too much discretion in the carrier's hands in two manners. One, it allows them to set fees for services where there's not an MAR. They can set fees, and apparently they're very different fees depending upon the fee structure of the individual carrier, which is not subject to review as best I can tell. And two, it allows the carrier to determine timing and ultimately to delay and delay and delay, and so it puts a lot of discretion and power into the carrier's hands, and by delegating that discretionary power, there's been an illegal delegation here.
I understand your question completely, but we respectfully need to point out that there are many other controls and safeguards in the system. It is certainly true, Justice O'Neill, that any insurance carrier or other third-party payor has to exercise the discretion over which bill to review and or audit. The court should understand that in the system, annually there are more than tens of millions of...
Well, I'm not talking about so much which bill to audit.
Okay.
It's the ability to draw out the audit. Is there any methodology whereby a provider can expedite the audit or get it up for review sooner?
Absolutely. If you look at the actual rules themselves, and I must confess, they're quite complicated, and that's of necessity because of the need to regulate, which is what this system does. But specifically to answer your question, Justice O'Neill, the rules require that the carrier must notify the healthcare provider if it intends to do any on-site audit, and it only has 14 days, as I think Mr. Schenken will address more from the carrier perspective, the specific time limits involved. But all the power is not in the insurance carrier. What patient advocates has failed...
Well, let me just redirect for a moment. I mean,
okay.
The crux of their argument, I think, is that the review procedure is so timely that by dragging it out to the maximum of the review procedures and delay payment for so long, it forces the provider to just give up early and say, okay.
Let me address that directly, and thank you for refocusing me. What patient advocates doesn't tell you is the regulations require that if a carrier audits a bill after the 60th day from the date the complete medical bill was submitted, the carrier must pay interest to the health care provider on that bill. So there is, in fact, a positive incentive for the carrier or other payor to promptly complete the audit and to promptly pay, or if they deny payment based upon the audit, allow the provider to go forward. And the interest will, in fact, accrue. The second thing that's a control mechanism that I think answers your question is that the commission has a compliance and practices division. Anytime a healthcare provider feels that any insurance carrier is unduly harassing them or is unduly delaying an audit in an attempt to slow pay, they may file a complaint with the Compliance and Practices Division, who will, in fact, under the Commission's own separate independent audit authority, review that situation and, if it's appropriate, assess administrative penalties on that carrier.
Well, let me ask you, in that respect, what does the record reflect about the Commission's oversight? And in particular, are there instances that the record shows in which the Commission has come down, has penalized for a delay of the carrier in auditing or evaluating the claim? Has it found actually improper auditing or accounting procedures?
To answer your question, Justice Jefferson, I'm not sure the record itself from the courts below reflects that specific thing, but I believe in the amicus brief filed by Texas Mutual, they specifically cite some of the figures by the Workers' Comp Commission. I can tell you that generally for the last 3 or 4 years, the Commission has assessed administrative penalties collectively against insurance carriers over $1 million a year. This is for all sorts of violations that of the provisions of the Act that occur. So the Commission expressly exercises that tight control to prevent a runaway carrier from just slow paying or avoiding their responsibilities. By contrast, and to show you the distinction, only about $50,000 roughly year in and year out has been assessed against healthcare providers for administrative violations of the Act. I believe, Justice Jefferson, that's the closest evidence or mention of any form, because we simply didn't address that. It wasn't a part of the specific case at the trial court nor in the Court of Appeals.
And the federal courts, when they talk about this, what they term a sub-delegation, one of the primary factors that they look at is whether there is a conflict of interest. And I note that the Court of Appeals, at least, says that all parties agree that there's a conflict of interest here. Why doesn't that amount to an improper sub-delegation?
Well, as the Court held in both the Boll-Weevil case and in the FM Properties case, there are 8 factors to be looked at, no one of which is controlling. And we certainly don't dispute the fact that there may very well be certainly some degree of tension between a healthcare provider who wants to get paid as much as possible and an insurance carrier who has a statutory responsibility to pay not more than the medical fee guideline allows. But that's only one factor. If the court were to take a look at this from the Boll-Weevil delegation standards and really look at all 8 of the factors, which the third court did not do, you will, in fact, I think, as we point out in our brief on page 21, ascertain that a careful examination and application of the Boll-Weevil factors, even if this is a delegation, which we say it is not, those factors are all satisfied by the governmental control and all of the other key things. I'm running out of some of my main time, and I'd like to give Mr. Schenken the opportunity to present his portion. But let me just remind the court and say this as I hopefully step off the podium.
Before you do that, let me ask you a question. You've been calling the procedures an audit, so that may suggest the answer to my question. The Workers' Compensation Commission argues, at least in part, that the review procedures or audit are to enable the carrier to ensure that the amount of the payment to the health care provider is the correct amount, a reasonable and fair amount, not too high, perhaps not too low. On the other hand, it's been argued that it's a delegation of complete audit responsibility that the commission has. Which is it, and does it make a difference to the outcome in this case?
The answer is it is not a delegation of the commission's power at all, and that's why I mentioned specifically Section 408.027, Justice Wainwright. Carriers have a legislatively recognized responsibility to look at medical bills. The commission's audit authority is totally separate and distinct. I would refer the court to Sections 413 and 414 of the Texas Labor Code, because it is in those two specific sections where you will find all of the commission's authority to audit health care providers, insurance carriers, and anyone else in the system.
Aren't those the same statutes, however, that the commission uses to justify the insurer's ability to conduct these reviews?
They are both. They are all part of the Texas Labor Code, that carefully crafted scheme by which the commission oversees the process.
So the commission's review authority comes from the same statutes as the carrier's, at least alleged, delegated review authority.
But it does indeed. It's just in different
parts. But your argument
parts.
Is they're distinct.
Right. They're separate and distinct, and that's the key point that the Court of Appeals missed on the delegation issue. With that, and I would like to now yield time to Mr. Schenken to address.
Let me ask you one quick question.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're calling this a review and an audit, which implies some sort of review-type procedure, but the argument's made that it's more than just a review, it's a fee setting, and that is strictly within the auspices of the commission, and it's a fee setting because each carrier has a different structure in terms of what they're going to pay, and that seems to me to be the crux of their argument in the delegation case.
And you sort of had that in your first question, and we got away from it, so let me try to address that very specifically. The provision that is complained of is found in in Rule 133.304I. This is the specific commission rule which sets up the non-MAR situation. That rule, and if you look at the preamble to it, which is mentioned, by the way, in their brief.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt you, but
okay.
Also the MAR situation, is my understanding, that just sets a maximum. It doesn't set the actual rate. So I believe their fee-setting argument includes those that have MARs, because the carrier can pay anything within a certain range.
No, and that's totally incorrect. If you look at the rules and the statute itself, insurance carrier and other payors have only two choices. They have to pay, assume it's a proper medical bill and it's for a compensable service, the carrier either has to pay the maximum allowable reimbursement set by commission rule, where for any of the 8,000 procedures it has set a MAR, or it pays the carrier's charge, whichever's less. The carrier has absolutely no discretion in a MAR situation to pay anything that it sees fit. And now I'd like to, if I may, continue my answer to point out the distinction, because this is critical. In 133.304I, which is the non-MAR rule, the commission has given insurance carriers specific direction and authorization to determine a methodology for paying certain narrow instances of medical treatment for which the commission has not established that maximum allowable. However, the commission has specifically also told those carriers that when you do that, you must apply the statutory standard found in Section 413.011, and is now found in Section D. At the time this case started, it was subsection B. That's the fair and reasonable standard that we've talked so much about, Justice O'Neill. So the short answer is carriers absolutely do not have discretion.
I think I heard you just say that each carrier can set up their own methodology under nothing more than just fair and reasonable.
There's a little more than fair and reasonable, because when you look at the statutory standards, what you will realize is that it's fair and reasonable, it must ensure access to quality medical care, and it must achieve effective cost control. Furthermore, the carrier has to take in doing this, has to take into consideration the extra security of payment. And finally, they cannot pay more than that which would be allowed by a person paying for their own medical care or if an insurance carrier was paying for it.
Other than those broad guidelines, it's pretty much up to the carrier what to charge in that situation.
It is subject to, and this is also important, and Pat doesn't tell you that, it is subject to commission review. Because if a health care provider feels that methodology has not paid them fair and reasonable, they may ask for medical dispute resolution internally to the commission. If they are dissatisfied with that, they get a de novo hearing at the State Office of Administrative Hearings, which the court knows is an independent cadre of highly trained and capable administrative law judges. And finally, if they're still dissatisfied with the amount of payment, they have judicial review now since this court's decision in Continental Casualty to the District Courts of Travis County.
Thank you, counsel. The court will allow 5 minutes for Mr. Shinkin.
May it please the court, I'm Pete Shinkin. I'm representing Amicus Curiae, Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a state-created nonprofit mutual insurer that only does workers' compensation, participating by permission of the commission. And I'm really here to try to answer questions, so I think what I'd like to do is follow up on the questions that have been asked so far. Justice O'Neill, your question about do the non-MAR cases under that one provision of the dispute and audit rules present a special problem. Obviously, they present more of an issue than most of the rules. For most fees, for most services, for most of these 8,000 CPT codes, the fee is set in the rule, and that's what that is the appropriate payment that the carrier is supposed to make.
So when it says maximum allowable, it doesn't really mean maximum allowable. It means they have to pay that amount.
Well, as Mr. Helmkamp said, actually the rules generally say the lesser of the provider's usual and customary charge or the MAR. And in most cases, really except for pharmacies, the MAR is the lesser because pharmacies are the only ones that have competition. So in general, the rules read the lesser of the charge or the MAR, but in practice, and in all the cases involved in the 96 fee guideline that we're dealing with here, it's going to turn out to be the MAR. So then focusing on those services which the commission has said are too unusual or too variable for them to set a MAR, and where they've told the carrier, you have to develop a methodology, it has to be consistent, you have to disclose it in your notice when you deny or reduce payment on the basis of your methodology, what's the reason why, if that's a delegation, it's not an unconstitutional delegation? First, I do not concede that it's a delegation. This is a system in which providers do what providers have to do, bill. Carriers do what they have to do, review bills. That system would exist under any scenario. And the government regulates every step in the process, the billing, the payment, and the disputes. But if, and this is the harder case, this is the one that looks more like a delegation. If you say it's a delegation, then what's the safeguard? The safeguard is there is review. Your Honor indicated some doubt as to whether there was review available. But 413.031 of the Labor Code and some of these very dispute and audit rules that the court below held unconstitutional provide that any party, specifically including a provider, is entitled to review of any carrier reduction or denial of payment.
If we determine that there has been a delegation of governmental power here, do you think that we should consider a different test from Boweevil for this because it's a sub-delegation from an agency? If there's a delegation, will one size fit all?
I think the Boweevil standards are generally the appropriate ones. I think in applying them, the court can take some additional comfort when the context is delegation by an agency from the fact that agencies and their decisions are subject to additional review by the courts that legislative decisions are not. Legislative decisions are essentially only subject to constitutionality review. Agency decisions, if it's review of a rule, as in this case, are subject first to review for is the rule consistent with the statute? And second, as the court is aware, consistent for it reviewed for consistency with the rulemaking procedural requirements set up by the legislature. Has the agency given a reasoned justification for making the decisions that it has made in the rulemaking? If the agency is applying the system, the delegated power, through contested cases, those decisions are separately reviewable, as the SOA decisions in this scheme are
reviewable. Are they all separately reviewable because of the of what? What statute gives judicial review?
The Labor Code was amended, Your Honor, in the 2001 session, I believe it was, of the Texas Legislature. After your decision, this Court's decision in Functional Restoration Associates versus Continental Casualty held that there wasn't a specific Labor Code right of judicial review of these decisions and that the parties hadn't properly preserved the inherent constitutional right of review or the APA right of review issue, the legislature went back and put that into the Labor Code, specifically 413.031K, I believe is where it now is. Your Honor, in addition...
Anybody have a question?
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you
Thank
very
you,
much.
Counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Ms. Jennifer Ridd will present argument for the respondents.
Thank you. May it please the Court. If these rules just directed insurance carriers about how to process bills, as the Commission and the amicus contend so strenuously in their briefs, then it's hard to see how declaring these rules invalid could possibly eviscerate the entire Commission system of reviewing medical services provided by healthcare providers to injured workers. The heart of this case and the heart of Dr. Merrill's concern and patient advocates' concern is whether reasonable healthcare providers have to guess at whether they will be paid and how much they will be paid before they provide services to injured workers in Texas. Our concern about
How would that be different if the process moved in-house to the Commission?
Because in-house, we wouldn't have an interested party. There
you
are many...
You wouldn't know. I mean, even the... You would not have any more information necessarily than you would than you do this way.
Actually, we would have more information because under the section for which there is no maximum allowable reimbursement, the one that Justice O'Neill was inquiring about, insurance carriers right now apply their own methodology about whether to deny payment because services are unnecessary. They exercise their own discretion about whether to decide whether services are not related to the injury. Those are for situations where the medical fee guideline does establish an MAR. They may apply their own methodology, their own underwriting guidelines, which may be different from carrier to carrier. Where there is a maximum allowable reimbursement, they are actually directed in the rules to develop their own methodology. It's not subject to notice and comment rulemaking, and although the Workers' Comp Commission tells them, carrier, be consistent, apply your methodology to similar situations in a consistent manner, there is no requirement that they compare their underwriting guidelines and their methodology to other carriers, nor is there any disclosure requirement. If that function were with the Commission...
Until after the service is rendered. They have to disclose at the time they... Reject the claim or...
Yes.
But you mean ahead of time?
Well, even when they reject the claim, they have to give an explanation of benefits. And the explanation of benefits says why we're rejecting. And they can't just say not within guidelines. That's clear. But do they have to actually disclose their methodology? There is no affirmative requirement on them to disclose the methodology. And that's part of our concern. What has been delegated is essentially rulemaking power. Rulemaking power that is not subject to notice and comment review. And so there are really different things that actually are delegated. This is not just the review of bills. What the rules do is allow the carriers to actually make a decision. To make a decision and require that the provider even go through a motion for rehearing process where they submit a request for reconsideration to the carrier, and then the carrier can say, sorry, we're going to stick with our decision, and then the healthcare provider appeals pursuant to 413.031. Our view is what should happen and what the legislature intended is that the Workers' Comp Commission is the arbiter. And that if a carrier says, for our internal reasons, we don't want to pay a bill, then what they do is they pay 50% of the amount charged, and they seek dispute resolution. And what I heard Mr. Helmkamp say is, the Workers' Comp Commission, we can't do this. They're just, it would be too expensive. We just don't have the manpower to make these decisions. But unfortunately, that's what the legislature has said for them to do, that they are the one who should be making this decision. And many of our concerns would go away. And I think, in fact, many of the provisions of these rules would probably not be at issue if it were a neutral party that got to make the decision. Justice Phillips asked Mr. Schenken whether a different standard should apply when we're talking about a subdelegation, a different standard from the Boll-Weevil standard. Boll-Weevil and FM Properties really based their decision on separation of powers, but footnote 10 in the Boll-Weevil case and Justice Heck's dissent did go into the issue of due process, and due process is primarily the concern when you have a third party, particularly one with a pecuniary interest making the decisions. Many of our concerns in this case and many of the things that the courts have looked at in delegation cases, when the court says, well, there are no bright lines, it's really a matter of degree, many of the problems in this case and many of the problems for the health care providers would go away if the decision maker were neutral. And if, in fact, the decision maker...
I'm having trouble following you because you say we would be better off if the providers got paid and the carriers had to complain. Well, but why is that any more or less a delegation than if they don't get paid and they have to complain? It looks to me like at some point somebody's got to go to the commission and get it resolved.
Exactly. And it's our view that that's what the whole system was set up to do. The commission has...
That's what's happening. You go, if you disagree, you go to the commission and get a decision, don't you?
No, because you have an added layer of decision-making power. What the commission has done is delegate to the carriers the power to actually make a decision that then the carriers have the burden of appealing under the dispute resolution process.
The providers have the burden.
The providers have the burden in every instance. And that shifting of the burden, it's not just a matter of delay and expense, although there is substantial expense and delay involved, but it would be akin to a rule of the court telling a plaintiff, you don't get to go to court until you first submit to the defendant, say in a personal injury case, your complaint and all your discovery, and not just your discovery or what you're going to rely on, but anything the defendant wants to look at. You got to let the defendant look at it. And then if the defendant says, I don't think your claim states a cause of action, then you have to ask him for reconsideration. And only after you've gone through that whole process can you file your petition in court. That's what we have going on here. And our position is, sure, they can disagree with the bill. And if we want to accept what they pay us, we go away. And if the Workers' Comp Commission medical fee guideline is what it should be, a presumptively reasonable fee, then half the time, if that's what they pay, the provider's going to know, ooh, I have to overcome that presumption if I'm going to appeal.
I mean, I can see that, it may be a better idea or a worse idea for somebody to have the burden or not to have the burden. But I don't see how that's a delegation, because either the bill is presumptively right and the carrier has to go to the commission and complain, or there's some audit involved and the provider has to go to the commission. But somebody's got to go. How does that make that a delegation? That's what I'm missing.
Because they get to make a decision and shift the burden, because they actually get to apply their own methodology, guidelines, and underwriting principles without disclosing them, because they actually get to develop, in the case of the MAR, their own underwriting guidelines and apply them.
That's the focus that I've had. Is it seems like the big complaint is that the provider is subject to differing methodologies that appear to be fairly random, and there's no vehicle to make them standardized, which should be the role the TWCC plays. It's more of an ad hoc review determination as opposed to the TWCC setting the methodology in the first instance.
That is exactly right. And unlike the Third Court of Appeals decision in the Office of Public Interest Counsel case, this is not a situation where the Commission reviews the methodology developed by the carriers. If you look at 133.305, what actually happens in dispute resolution, contrary to what counsel says, those rules on their face do not give healthcare providers the opportunity to challenge the methodology. In fact, the carriers contend that their methodology and their underwriting guidelines are confidential and are not available under the Open Records Act.
Well, is it possible that then if a provider does the same service for five different patients with five different providers, there could be differing fees for all five?
Absolutely.
And the provider can never know what methodology they use, and so therefore can never challenge the methodology, but can only challenge the amount on an ad hoc basis.
That is correct, and that's what we believe, why there is really no review, no meaningful review. The first test in Bollweevil for what's occurring here is we don't have a vehicle to challenge the failure to disclose the methodology or to even know what it is. And the issues are very limited in the medical dispute resolution process.
Ms. Riggs, ultimately, though, isn't there an appeal to the State Office of Administrative Hearings, SOA, so that consistent principles, if your complaint is that they're inconsistent before that point, are applied to everyone? Isn't there someone from the Workers' Comp Commission or some entity riding herd over the whole process?
There is review. Whether it is adequate, we do not believe it is adequate. The first test of Bollweevil says it has to be an opportunity for meaningful review. If the provider does not get to know what the standards are, if they are a secret standard applied by the carrier, if they make up the law and then apply the law and we don't get to know what it is in that initial stage, our review of that decision is not going to be a meaningful review. But we agree that the first part, there is a review process, and it is a de novo review in front of the State Office of Administrative Hearings, but that's two stages away. And the second test in Bollweevil is whether you have an adequate representative or you're adequately represented in the very first hearing process. And what we're talking about here is that the carriers aren't just processing bills. They're authorized to go in and audit. They can do an on-site or a desk audit. And for anyone who's ever answered an interrogatory and said, look at the documents, you know that sometimes a desk audit can be equally intrusive as an on-site audit. So our concern there as well is that there's a process there, and we are not adequately represented in that process. And so it's questionable. The first element, I can't say absolutely there is no meaningful review. It's not as meaningful as it should be, but is it as clear-cut as the element was in the Bollweevil case? No.
I understand the argument about the non-MAR setting being fee-making or fee-setting. What about the MAR situation? I understand that there are guidelines, but my understanding of the way it works is it's a floor unless the provider seeks less. And where is their discretion there with the carrier?
Actually, the way the MAR works is it's a ceiling and there is no floor, and that's part of our concern. The Workers' Comp Commission rules do say, carrier, you should pay either the maximum allowable reimbursement or the usual charge, whichever is less. But there are many, many ways under the rules where the carriers could come in and say that a particular service is not necessary, is not medically necessary. So the fact that there has been a fee set for it, it still leaves them the room to apply their discretion to decide whether it's medically necessary. And in that process, in the process that's established in these rules, we don't really get to know who makes that decision. Do we know whether, for example, a spine surgeon is reviewing the bills of a spine surgeon? Do we know whether a spine surgeon with the insurance carrier is, in fact, deciding whether a particular surgery was medically necessary?
Well, if it's determined that it's not medically necessary, do they just deny it or do they adjust the fee?
Well, actually, they cannot. They will deny it. And
so it can't really be fee setting.
I see the distinction, and that is different from fee setting, but it is still applying their discretion to decide whether a fee will be paid, which gets back to, aren't my clients entitled to know what standards will guide whether they are being paid, much less how much? Because many of the problems here are with pre-authorization decisions and whether ancillary services will be allowed. Medical necessity is at the heart of many of the medical fee dispute cases. There are statistics cited in the Workers' Comp Commission brief and in amicus briefs that demonstrate the number of claims that deal with medical necessity, because that is the vehicle that's used by the carriers using some their own standards, which may vary from carrier to carrier, to deny reimbursement. The
Could
same
you briefly contrast this system with medical providers' remedies and obligations in private contracting for services, particularly where the patient has private insurance.
Well,
it sounds to me like a lot of what you're complaining about is endemic to 21st century health care.
There's a big difference, and that's because in a private care situation, there are different remedies. And if a carrier has a contract, and if a provider is providing services, say, in a managed care context, they have the right, the carrier and the provider, they can argue as they wish. Whatever the contract says, they can, if it requires them to engage in alternative dispute resolution, if it requires them to submit information to the carrier, that's a matter of contract. But what we have here is a statutory entitlement to payment under 413.011 for fair and reasonable reimbursement for services that are provided. It is the all three of the factors are relevant, not just fair and reasonable, but access to quality medical care and cost containment. So we have a statutory right. It's very different than when a healthcare provider is negotiating with a provider. So, and a provider, as the amicus acknowledges, they don't have to provide insurance to employers in Texas, but once they do, under the statute that has been cited numerous times by counsel, 408.027, they shall pay the fee allowed under 413.011. So they have a statutory obligation to pay the fees. The commission is the one that sets the fees, and it is the commission that is the one that establishes what should be both the application of the methodology and developing the methodology for fair and reasonable fees.
You don't contend that the commission could set MARs in advance for every conceivable procedure?
No, of course not. And
so there has to be a system when something has been done that isn't routinely done.
Exactly. And I think there are ample cases that deal with situations in which ad hoc rulemaking is appropriate. But in this area, there are national the Code of Procedural Terminology does establish standard values for particular services and even establishes the various different geographic regions where there may be variances in healthcare costs. So it is, we'd be better off if they, in fact, did set fees. And, of course, that gets to our argument that they do not, in fact, have the authority to set fees, and that what this court should do is say that if that's, in fact, what they are trying to do, and that they have to have express statutory authority to, in fact, set fees. What they currently have the authority to do is very similar to that which the court addressed in the Defebot case, that they have the authority to establish presumptively reasonable fees. But what, in fact, they have done is rate making, and it's our position that when they engage in rate making, you should have a contested case procedure so you can ascertain the facts and develop an evidentiary record to justify the amount of fees.
And you don't think you can raise that in a complaint about a particular bill?
Can't you just go in
and say this is an unreasonably low amount for this service?
And providers do it. I believe one of the some of the statistics show 4,800 times in 2002. What they don't show is you...
First half, I think it was.
Yes. They do that over and over again.
One about half the time, according to the statistics.
And they do that very often. Many, many do not. I mean, if you look at the total volume of bills that are processed, the number of times when there are contests are limited. But there are also a situation in which do we want to have a situation where health care providers are leaving?
But would you, come back to the question again, would you be satisfied from the delegation point of view, not the other arguments that you made, if the commission had a rule that said, okay, the provider sends the carrier a bill, the carrier just says yes or no, and if the carrier says no, then the provider has to come to the commission and say we want the money, and then we're going to have a hearing and we're going to ask the carrier, why won't you pay this? And the carrier's going to say, because this is the way we audit bills, and they'll have a hearing about that, and then there'll be a decision one way or the other. Would that satisfy the delegation concerns?
I think what would satisfy the delegation concerns and the statutory authority concerns is what is expressly stated in 408.027. They either pay it, or if they don't, if the carrier doesn't want to pay it, then they show why. They have the burden of showing why to the commission it should not be paid.
So the crux of the argument is that because the burden is on the provider to go to the commission, that's the delegation.
That's part of the delegation. Part of it, of course, is the MAR and the development of the methodologies and the applying the methodologies, applying the law to particular individuals, as the court rejected in both Bollweevil and the FM Properties case.
You have a number of other arguments that you raised in the Court of Appeals that the court did not need to address because of their view of the delegation, and you still urge those arguments.
Yes, we do, Your Honor. Very, very strenuously.
Ms. Riggs, you mentioned earlier that not having what you called an objective party involved to provide what might be a reasonable payment for a service, you called it the conflict of interest, is the source of many of your concerns with the delegation. Is that the linchpin of your concern and the linchpin of your argument, this conflict situation?
Decision on separation of powers rather than due process, but did discuss the due process elements. And I think we did raise due process in the trial court. And I think the due process is an element of the delegation or the non-delegation doctrine. And I think that is what makes a delegation to a private entity more onerous and subject to heightened scrutiny. And here we think it should be an even more heightened scrutiny because it is not even a legislative delegation to carriers, which, by the way, I will point out, as our amicus from the Hospital Association brief indicated, the legislature expressly considered and rejected. But what we have here is a sub-delegation by the commission to the private entity. So it's not even a legislative enactment. So we do believe that due process requires an even more heightened standard, and that underlies many of our concerns. The exercise of discretion by one with a pecuniary interest is what makes the delegation most objectionable.
If your conflict concern is resolved against you, do you necessarily lose that part of the argument?
Absolutely not. We still meet. There are a number of other elements under the Bollweevil test which are still established, and as the court has said, it's not. You don't have to meet all eight. You don't even have to consider all eight. You have to look at all of the factors and apply all of them.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Members of the court, there were several misstatements that have been made, and I think maybe more accurately, a misimpression that's been left by what's gone on here. I only have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and I cannot possibly in that short time address everything. But I need to come back to Justice O'Neill's question about the five different patients by the same doctor with five different patients covered by five different carriers. The impression may have been left with you that in all situations there's going to be five different payments, and I want to make sure you understand. If it is a MAR, one of those 8,500 medical procedures for which the commission has painstakingly established a maximum allowable reimbursement level, those five patients for that one physician will be paid at exactly the same rate. There is no secret methodology. That is simply a red herring.
I think the premise of the question was strictly non-MAR payments.
And let me then address that, because I want to make sure that you did understand that. Only in the non-MAR situation may there be differing payments by differing health care providers. But that does not constitute an improper delegation, because each one of those five situations on those five patients must meet the statutory standards of fair and reasonable, et cetera, that we've talked about before. And most importantly,
what's fair and reasonable is going to be different according to how each carrier internally factors their methodology, and which no one ever knows. So
well, and that's a misnomer too, Your Honor. But first, the payment will be fair and reasonable as ultimately judged by the commission at medical dispute resolution, next by SOA if a dissatisfied party goes there, and finally by the court.
You seem to say the review fixes it all, but my understanding of the review is unpredictable because the methodologies are unknown and you can't get to the methodologies, and so therefore it's this random sort of review.
And that's just not true. If I may quote to you from, this is from one of the rules. This is provided under tab 4 of the judge's book that was provided to you. It's 133.304. Specifically, it is subsection I and then little bullet 2. It's actually, if you go to tab 4, it's about the third or fourth rule in there. It's 133.304, and it's on page 2. But it specifically says, when the insurance carrier pays a health care provider for treatments and or services for which the commission has not established a maximum allowable reimbursement, the insurance carrier shall, number one, develop and consistently apply a methodology to determine fair and reasonable. Most importantly, number two, Justice O'Neill, explain and document the method it used to calculate the rate of pay and apply this method consistently. So it is simply incorrect to say that they don't know what the methodology is, because there is always discovery, but more importantly, by rule, the commission has exercised that governmental control to make sure that there's no secret rulemaking and no hidden underwriting decisions. That's just simply not the case. We haven't really said much about the validity of the medical fee guideline and really the one-year rule. I'd like to briefly say that the Court of Appeals absolutely, on these two points, got it right. The commission complied more than substantially.
What has happened with the rule since the Court of Appeals decision?
I beg your pardon?
What has happened? How are things going forward in the last 14 months?
Well, I'd like to say I'm glad you asked, because what's happened, and this has been one of the reasons we had to appeal to this court, healthcare providers, some of them around the state of Texas, have interpreted the Court of Appeals decision in this case as virtually wiping out any ability of an insurance carrier to review a medical bill. They've taken the position that they may proceed from any time an insurance carrier or other payor denies them payment, they may proceed directly to any court in the state of Texas, file suit on an unpaid debt, thereby failing to exhaust administrative remedies. And that's one of the things that has really happened over the misapplication and misunderstanding of the statutory principles by the Court of Appeals.
And you agree that there are other, or do you, that there are other constitutional issues that the Court of Appeals did not need to address and would have to be addressed before the respondent's position?
I do, and that's the unfortunate thing about the time we have allotted for oral argument. I mean, it is what it is, and we do the best we can to answer your questions and raise the points that we think are important. What I can say to you in closing is there's been enormous briefing done on this case by amicus, by the parties themselves. There's also an enormous amount of statutory material. You really need, as you grapple with these constitutional issues, not just the ones we've argued, but the ones we haven't, take a look at the statutory provisions that are cited for you in our briefs. Take a look at the rules themselves, 133.301 to 133.305. You will see that what those rules do, members of the court, is they regulate with great specificity how insurance carriers and other payors shall do their business, and they delegate nothing. I thank the court.
Thank you.
My time is up. May I say one personal thing to the court?
Is there a question?
Tomorrow is my last day as an assistant attorney general. I will never, in all likelihood, have the opportunity to argue before the court, because I won't be doing any more litigation. It has been my honor and privilege to have presented three arguments to the Texas Supreme Court. Thank you.
That concludes the argument in today's case. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.
Oyez, the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now adjourned.
Staff attorney or briefing attorney for the First Court in Houston, and on a personal note, her resume reflects that she has been a champion in the rifle, shooting a rifle, and also more recently tennis, so watch it if you're going to ask her to play a tennis game. Next to her is Randy Roach, a practitioner both in Houston and Austin, board certified in civil appellate law and former chair of the appellate practice section of the Houston Bar Association. And also what particularly suits him to our task today is he's been director of appellate advocacy at the University of Houston Law Center since 1994. And then completing our panel is former Justice Woody Jones from the Austin Court of Appeals, where he served for 12 years with great distinction. Overwhelmingly, his statistics are that he authored more than 1,500 opinions, takes my breath away, helping decide roughly 5,000 appeals. And he's now in private practice with a great new appellate boutique, and I didn't get paid for this. Alexander DeBose, Jones and Townsend. We'll have other members of the firm in the program as we proceed. So I'll now turn it over to the panel. Please welcome all three if you would.
Thanks, Nina, very much. The panel has elected me moderator, so let me just discuss what we're going to try to do. First, I think all the panel feels the same way about the oral argument. Whether you had the opportunity to decline or apparently not, it was a great argument, and we really appreciate it. And I think everybody in the room, everybody in the video, appreciates it very much. And you all are also very brave to stay here for this. Well, if you want to leave now. Actually, when we did this last year, it was we critiqued a live argument to the Third Court of Appeals here in Austin, and the advocates were all asked to leave so that we would feel more comfortable. We decided this time that that wasn't necessary because that dude got tough skins, that's right, and because everybody listened to the tape afterwards last year, so it didn't make any... So knowing that, we're not spared anything. And let me tell you why we're not going to be all that kind. The story goes like this. About 6 or 7 years ago, there was a live argument to the Third Court of Appeals, and it was critiqued by a panel, and then we didn't do it for a while. And the reason it didn't happen for about 5 or 6 years, according to the Planning Committee, was that, and your reaction to it, you, the audience, thought that you didn't get very much out of the critique precisely because everybody just said, what a great job, and really had nothing negative to say. So the express challenge last year as this year is that in order to make this valuable for you, we've got to be negative as well as positive. And so that's, we're going to be honest, I think, in our critiques. Now let me qualify that a little bit. Teaching appellate advocacy at UT and at U of H each year to law students, I firmly believe that people only learn through other people's mistakes. I mean, it's important to have credibility to talk about the positives, and so we will be positive. On the other hand, I think the only way for people to learn things is to hear people say, I don't think that works, and here's why. So to the extent that I do that, please know that it's because I truly believe that that is the best teaching method for this.
Let me give you our pseudonyms that we've adopted for today. On my far right is Paula Abdul.
Wait, we have not adopted these. Woody has adopted these. Okay, I just want to set that out.
I am Ruben. And this is Simon.
My kids are going to love that. Okay, so So with one more caveat, what we're going to do is hopefully be very conversational. We're going to interrupt. We're going to interject. We're going to disagree with each other as appropriate. So, and if you have questions, I think we'll try to leave some time at the end. Lord knows we've been allotted too much time probably to use just by talking ourselves. I was delegated with the responsibility of going first, and what we're going to do is take each of the arguments kind of sequentially. So let me talk about Dewey's opening argument. The best thing I can say, I think, is that Dewey has a demeanor at the podium that we should all aspire to. He is professional. He is incredibly respectful of the court. He wants to be understood, and it is just clear that he is working to give the court as much information that is helpful to them as he can possibly do. And, you know, he speaks slowly and distinctly, and so you can understand him. And in any oral argument, precisely because there's so little time available, the instinct to go fast and to cover a lot is often overwhelming. And Dewey, I think, deserves top marks for approaching this as, I've got a few things to say, and I want to make sure that you understand what it is I have to say. So I thought that was the single best thing about his argument. Second thing that I liked was the way that he began the argument, being very clear about the two rulings that he was looking for and how he was going to proceed with the argument in terms of dividing up time. I'm sure the court was very curious to know how the time was going to be allotted between him and Pete, and he didn't hide the ball on that. Of course, more importantly, telling the court exactly what it is that he was going to focus on and what he thought was the most important rulings that he could ask from the court. I think that's important.
Let me interject here. And first, let me give a caveat. All three of the people who argued today are dear friends of mine. So that makes it doubly tough for me to be brutally candid. Of course, luckily, I think they all did a wonderful job. Let me just say that I had mixed feelings about the petitioner's opening 90 seconds. You all heard that the first 90 seconds are the most important because that's where you really get the court's attention. Dewey has what is almost a professorial demeanor, but I didn't see as much punch, perhaps, in the first 90 seconds as I would have liked. I think it was very good to lay out for the court, this is what I intend to do, this is what we are asking the court to do, but I know my partner, Doug Alexander, says that you've got to use those first 90 seconds to really make your argument a page-turner, where you're anxious to hear what's coming next. And what I heard was more along the lines of almost kind of housekeeping, which was helpful in one way, but in another way, it was not perhaps as punchy as it could have been.
Well, I agree with that. I had written down, in fact, just when I was reading the briefs, and I just want to say there was a lot of briefing. This case has, I have a notebook up here. I'd read for a while, and then I'd say, okay, I got to go make a copy of the rules. So I'd make a copy of the rules. And then I'd say, okay, they're talking about boll weevil. I got to go get boll weevil. There's a lot of information that the judges had to read, a lot of information that the parties had to discuss, and they were important. They were the rules, to my mind, from a judicial standpoint, were the crux of the case. And so there was a lot of information that everybody had to get their arms around in order to make their point. And it is difficult in a case like that, especially with only 20 minutes. That's not very much time. It's very difficult to make a specific point. And I had written down notes to myself as I was reading that anyone arguing to the Supreme Court has to have a sense of urgency about them, as if they have a lot to say and too little time to say it. And that is exactly what they have. And so I do agree that I thought that in the opening, he did a very good job of saying what he wanted the court to do, and that was excellent. I thought that he could have had more of a sense of urgency about, look, these rules, they're not a delegation. They are not a delegation. They're specific enough, and this is why. And to my mind, that's what patients' advocates hit upon in their brief. That's what possibly should have been addressed in the opening. And I know that's getting into some of the details of the case, but in this case, you have to get into those a little bit. But generally, I do think there could have been more of a sense of urgency, although I have to say I thought everyone did an excellent job.
Well, let me throw in 2 cents there. I agree completely with the observations that it got to be really punchy at the very beginning, and that wasn't the approach that was used. And I do have a I had in my mind, just from reading the Court of Appeals opinion, what I thought would be kind of the one issue that if I were on the court, I would be most concerned with, and it was whether or not the document demand power given to carriers under the rules is an improper delegation. That's what I got out of the Court of Appeals opinion, and I think one way to have made this more punchy and to really grab people's attention is to say that seems to be where the Court of Appeals is coming from, and I want to directly respond to that at the outset, and then to spend 2 to 5 minutes talking about that issue. I think it would have sent the signal to the court that I know what your concern is, I'm going to address it directly, and I'm going to make sure that time pressures don't keep me from addressing this most fundamental issue. Now, from Dewey's perspective, there may be a much better way to articulate whatever the central problem is in the Court of Appeals opinion from as the Supreme Court's looking at it, but whatever it is, I think that is another way to approach it that would make it case more of a page-turner. On the other hand, let me say, while I was having that thought, it amazed me that the court allowed Dewey to go on for 3 minutes at least, without any questions. Was there a bet? There was a bet? Sure. And that's the book, right? Harriet O'Neill will ask the first question, and it will be within 15 to 90 seconds. And you got 3 minutes. So obviously you were saying something that they wanted to hear. Now, my take, I want to amplify, my last comment here is going to amplify on Judge Fowler's comment. I think there are just too many issues in this case. There's too many issues in the briefing, and there's too many issues in the oral argument to think that this is going to be anything other than an experience where you have got to focus on just a couple things. I mean, my view of this coming in was the best possible oral argument would say, I want to talk about the three most important things here. They are 1, 2, and 3. If the court disagrees, you know, they'll ask you questions about the other ones. But, and then to be on it, to be on those issues. The truth is that both sides, if you looked at the briefs, my take was there are multiple agendas that each side has, and they are not necessarily focused on the Court of Appeals opinion. If you looked at the briefs, I think you'd see that they were fighting, the parties are fighting among each other on some wide-ranging issues in terms of what healthcare providers are entitled to and, you know, things like that. So I didn't think that this argument, I thought this was going to be an incredibly difficult argument to get focus on, and I think that's probably the biggest criticism I have of the argument. Overall, both parties is that it didn't have that kind of focus on a few key issues. I do think that the court tried to identify those key issues, and we can talk about that.
The Court of Appeals opinion did focus on very specific areas, and it did seem as if everyone, and you can tell from the amount of time that the lawyers allotted to these other issues, but the two issues that the court affirmed on and said, no, those are not delegations, the 1-year statute of limitations and then the
Mayor?
Yeah, no, not the mayor. Thank you. Right. So they didn't talk about those, but the court was pretty specific in saying we think this is a delegation and we think this is a delegation. The court may not have been quite as specific in explaining why it thought that, but it certainly was clear that it did think that. That it did think that the power to audit, the power to get all of the documents and having the methodology and the provider not knowing what the methodology was. So it talked about those things, and it did interest me that the Court of Appeals opinion is what's going to get affirmed or reversed. And yet there wasn't much talk about it. And I probably would have, I think, in opening, talked a little bit more about those specific parts of the Court of Appeals opinion that I thought should have been affirmed or reversed.
Well, continuing on with the petitioner's argument and my thoughts about that, I thought that Dewey displayed a completely thorough knowledge of the record and also the applicable law. I would expect nothing less from somebody arguing before the Supreme Court, and all three advocates did a good job on that. Effectiveness in answering questions. I had some sympathy for Dewey because it's always so frustrating. You've got nine people up here. One of them asks a question. You get halfway through answering that question, and another judge jumps in with another question. So you really don't get to answer the first judge's question, and which makes it sound like you really haven't given a very thorough answer when, in fact, you weren't through. It is tough. It's nigh on impossible to really. And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how to train somebody how to answer questions in sound bites. I mean, somebody asks, one of the judges asks a question, and you really try to give them an honest, thorough answer, and you can't do that in a sound bite. And you try to lay it out and take 2 or 3 minutes, but long before you get through that 2 or 3 minutes of answering the question, you get interrupted by another judge's question.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, please do.
Would you? But
I wasn't going anywhere.
Unfortunately, you haven't had the opportunity to look at Randy's paper. Randy has done a paper, and it's a very good paper. And one of the points that Randy makes in it is that, probably for the Supreme Court, and frankly, we would really appreciate it if you would do this at the Court of Appeals level too, but especially at the Supreme Court where you have nine people up here, and just as an aside, as a judge being one of the nine, it's even difficult for the judges frequently to get a question in. You may be just about to ask a question, and somebody else asks it. You go, great, okay. And then it takes a while before another issue comes up that you wanted to ask a question about. So, I mean, it's difficult for everyone. Everyone, the judges, the parties, everyone's wanting to get either as much information as they can or give as much as they can. And I think in that setting, it is key. It may be impossible, but to try the impossible and come up with as many sound bites as you can, because that, I think, is going to be helpful in a setting like this. If they have a question about it, they can follow up. While I'm talking, I did want to mention one thing that I thought Dewey did a really good job with, and I think it was with Justice O'Neill. She had asked him a question or two, and he was answering, and she said, well, no, that's not what I really meant. And he said, well, thank you for refocusing me. And that was good. That was a really excellent thing to do. It shows respect to the court. It shows that you're interested in answering the court's questions, and you wanna give them information. And that was very good.
I agree with that line a lot. I thought that was really, really positive thing to do. But the thing that led up to it, I think we gotta talk about. And that is the sense that Harriet did not think that her questions were being answered. Now, to me,
Harriet often thinks that.
She may be back there. You better watch.
I'm sorry.
She's
it's
listening
true.
To the tape.
It's true.
Not as I speak, but she's listening to this tape right now. It seems to me that one of the most important things that an advocate can do in preparation is try to decide how they can answer questions as directly as possible. Requires you to anticipate the question, but I think most of these questions were anticipatable. A couple weren't, maybe, but the great majority were. And, you know, it seems to me that the downside of looking to a judge like you are evading their question is one of the worst possible things you can do. Now, sometimes that's done unintentionally because you didn't understand the question, and I frankly believe that the risk of not understanding a question but answering it anyway is so great, so awful, that it's much better to say, I'm not sure I understood the question, just to make sure that you are answering the right question. And frankly, it gives the added advantage of telling the court, I care intensely to make sure I know what your question is. So, but when I think a judge says, I don't think you're answering my question in a very nice way, I think that's a really bad place to be. And we've got to work, we as lawyers have got to work really hard in preparation to avoid that situation.
Well, again, I think it kind of gets back to the soundbite issue and figuring out, and the anticipation of questions issue. I do think that perhaps Dewey's answers were a little long, and maybe that's why he got interrupted. And I can empathize with that because I do the same thing. And I don't do well with sound bites, and I'll get a question, and you know, I'll start my wind-up in terms of answering the question, and it'll take me a sentence or two of wind-up, and that will give the court the impression somehow or other that I'm not really directly answering the question, and that's why they'll jump in with another question. And so somehow or other, the key is to not circle around the question and get closer and closer, but just give it a bullet-shot answer. And that's tough, but I think one of the keys is anticipating the questions.
Yeah, and I did just want to throw in, and I'm sure Woody would have said this as well, but he was thinking in another direction, but from the judge's perspective as well, it's not good when you miss the question. Now, I will ask bad questions occasionally, you know, where I can tell nobody could understand what that question was. And judges know when they've done that, but when they've asked a clear question and you should pick up on it, then that is a little irritating, especially in a case like this that just has so much. The judges, I know the parties are anxious, but the judges are just as anxious as the parties for all the information to come out because they want to write a good opinion. And so they want those details, and they want the right answer because everybody else down the line has some questions too. Should we move on?
Let me make one last comment, and it dealt with the stop sign. This argument featured a fair amount of oral argument after the stop sign went on for Dewey. Clearly, it was invited by the court. No question, both because there was a question with the stop sign up, and then even after Dewey made reference to the fact that the stoplight was on, Harriet asked another question. Now, what do you do in that circumstance? I advocate making it painfully clear to the court that you are very sensitive to the fact that you've been given extra time, and to demonstrate that by only basically answering the question in two sentences. And that didn't happen. Dewey took the opportunity and went with it, and I thought went uncomfortably long for me. So I would feel remiss if I didn't point that out.
And that does irritate some judges, just to let you know. Some judges will get irritated at that. Not that that's going to ultimately hurt you, but you don't want the judges irritated at you.
One.
Time and also the light, and I realized I need to get out of here as quickly, as gracefully as I can so he can have some time. And I think I tried twice.
Yeah, you were trying to leave. I know, they wouldn't let you. They didn't want you to leave yet. They had a few more questions.
Right. And then what they did, interestingly enough, just realizing that I had gone over a lot of time, they gave me 5 minutes.
And that. They were kind to do that. They didn't have to do that, but you know, you're right. You did at least twice try to leave. One final comment on Dewey. To me, the issue of credibility of the advocate is a key. And that applies to both the written brief and the oral argument. And credibility is determined in so many different ways. But I will just say that that Dewey's presentation and demeanor absolutely exuded credibility. I mean, I found myself saying, well, you just are going to believe whatever he says. I don't know that that's anything that can be learned. That may be just inherent in a person, and that's sort of their personality or something. But that was a very positive facet of the argument that I saw.
You want to start with Pete, Judge?
Okay. I thought that Pete did a good job. I thought he was very direct. He seemed to have a good idea specifically of what he wanted to talk about, and that was the audit rules, the review and audit rules. And he had very specific points to make. His sentences were very short, very clear. I thought it was very coherent. He answered the court's questions directly. I realize this is not negative, but I think that he probably had more of a focus to what he wanted to say. And that may have been settled beforehand, I don't know. But it seemed to me that there was he was zeroing in on one specific area that actually is, I know that y'all haven't had an opportunity, or some of you may, but probably most of you haven't had read the briefs, had the opportunity to do that. And so he was focusing in on really the crux of the argument that Patients Advocates was making. And the crux of his big problem from the Court of Appeals, where they lost in the Court of Appeals. And I thought he did an excellent job of that. And it was only 5 minutes, so he didn't have as much time as everybody else did to do some things that we might criticize. But I'm sure had he had more time, he wouldn't have done that anyway. But
I guess the 90-second rule does not apply to somebody in that situation who comes in with only 5 minutes. I mean, the issues have sort of already been set, and as I recall, Pete started out saying that what he wanted to do was follow up on the judge's questions that they already asked.
Well, and you know, really, I don't know how many of you were here last year or the year before, but we had a 5-minute argument last year as well. But it was by a party that had slightly different issues. It was not someone coming in and kind of echoing or attempting to focus the attention of the court to a specific area. And I think a 5-minute argument works much better in this setting, where your job is really just to come in behind the opener and redirect the court, get them focused, and then get out of there. That's a much better way of using a 5-minute argument than to use 5 minutes for your client who has different issues.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I mean, if Pete had been presenting a different argument and trying to do it in 5 minutes, that probably would have been a wasted 5 minutes.
I want to echo that, but I'm going to make a suggestion on how I might have done it differently. I absolutely agree that you send a perfect signal to the court. Say, I'm here to answer questions, and then you know, the ability to kind of cherry pick. The question that I think is the most important for me to spend my time on is fabulous. I mean, because that's what I think we should all do as advocates. We ought to try to figure out, from the questions that have been asked, where can I make the biggest positive contribution? And you did that. That was super. Now, I believe that in a 5-minute argument, no matter what you're doing, it really helps to give some sort of structure to the court at the very beginning. And while I heard, I'm here to answer questions, and the first question is this, maybe it's me, but I didn't hear any other, the second question, or the second most important question I think was asked was, you know, you, Justice Snyder, whatever. And then, and possibly even at the beginning, say, there were three questions that I think are really the crux of this case, and I want to deal with those questions. They are concerned this, that, and the other. That roadmap gives the court the ability to say, well, actually, I want to talk about question number three or question number two, something like that. Precious little time, but, you know, and I want to echo what he said. I clearly had the sense that the court thought you were being very responsive and that they thought they could get real help from you. And I strongly believe that that's probably the more important dynamic. What the court is sending to you signal-wise in terms of help us on this issue is much more valuable than whatever it is I have to say to the court. So that was very good. Should we talk about Jennifer? What do you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start on that. The first thing I tried to note on all three of these was the 90-second rule, the first 90-second rule. And I thought Jennifer did a super job in the first 90 seconds of really encapsulating what the issue was. As I recall, she used the phrase, "The heart of this case is," and then just laid it out. I thought that was very well done. I thought Jennifer also did a very good job of answering questions in more of a soundbite kind of way, or perhaps she was just not interrupted halfway through her questions as much as Dewey had been for whatever reason. But the question answering process was good. I don't know exactly what this means, but I had this sense that in about the last 5 minutes or so of Jennifer's argument, she started getting tired because I sensed a draining of energy. When she first got up, there was a lot of energy in her argument. The last 5 minutes, there was not so much. I'm not sure that one can do anything about that. It is a very intense 20 minutes. And I can imagine after about 15 of those, I would have used up most of my energy. But
could I throw in something?
Oh, absolutely.
I thought Jennifer did an excellent job in the opening. I agree with that. I do think she got right to the heart. And I thought she answered the questions very well. I thought she was very direct. One of the points that Randy talks about in his paper is to know your material so well and to have talked about it so much and to have said it over and over again so much that it's subconscious, it just kind of rolls off your tongue, and that short answers, short sentences come out. And that I felt that happened more with Jennifer's argument than with Dewey's argument. I thought that she was asked some interesting questions that were different than some of the questions that had come up before, and she directly answered them, and I thought that was very good. She, a couple of times, used some examples, which again Randy refers to in his paper, of, well, this is like, you know, telling a plaintiff, yada, yada, yada. You know, she used that example to compare what this situation is like for the providers, and that was good. Another thing that happened, I don't know this for certain, but I think she was thrown a softball, one or two, by Justice O'Neill, and she took them. She took them and ran with them.
Yes.
And that is an important thing to do.
Absolutely, yes, it is, and I noticed the same thing. Another positive thing I want to say about Jennifer's argument is that not only did she have somewhat shorter soundbite-like answers, but she seemed to exemplify that theory of having a theme that you come back to over and over. And it almost got to where no matter what the question was, she found a way to come back to that theme, which I thought was very effective.
Another way of confirming, I think, that the court felt like Jennifer was really giving direct responses to questions is I think Jennifer got better questions. Okay, I think they went more to the heart of the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, softball questions from Justice O'Neill, tough questions from Justice Heck. I thought on the issues that they really cared the most about. They are opportunities to go with it. And frankly, I preach this. I can't say that I do it. It's tough to do, but I think those are opportunities to talk more about that issue. I really don't think questions are just an opportunity to answer the particular of the question. I think often they are an invitation to address kind of the deeper issue that they are kind of referencing in their question, especially Justice Heck's questions. I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're kind of stand backish a little bit, but you know he's going straight to the jugular. So, you know, it's an interesting demeanor thing, but I think it really is an opportunity to go, and certainly a softball question has to be hit out of the home, out of the park, and I thought you did that, Jennifer.
Sometimes, though, superficial sounding questions may actually just be superficial.
From a Supreme Court judge, are you sure? I don't think so.
Here's the thing that I thought would have helped the argument. It goes back to structure. I didn't have a clear sense of, you know, you had a 3-point or 4-point, whatever it is, agenda. Mm-hmm. And when you thought Jennifer was getting tired, I just thought it was kind of mired in more detail without real context, without saying, here's how this answers the central question of this case or the question that you were asking. I think... Yes.
I would ask that the advocates, when you talk, which we invite, if you would come use the mic, because they cannot hear you at the back.
What she just said was that a loss of focus and a loss of energy pretty much go hand in hand.
Well, and that gets back to something that we were talking about earlier, which is, what do you do, what techniques do you use as an arguer to remember the most important points that you want to make? Do you bring something with you to the podium? Do you not? And I frankly did not remember to look to see what the different people who argued today brought to the podium with them. But you know, that's an important thing, and I wanted to ask Randy about that because
I did notice that there were very few references by anybody to any notes.
Right. You're right. Very little reference to that.
There was lots of good eye contact and. Demeanor in general was excellent.
Did y'all have written down anywhere the most important points that you wanted to make, and some little sheet of paper that you brought with you that you could refer to?
Well, I took what I had with me at the bench was the Boll-Weibel case. Mm-hmm. Turned to the most important page. I had the rules with my notes and highlights, along with the sections that I felt actually constituted delegations, and I had a one-page cheat sheet. And I try never to take more than a one-page cheat sheet because I'm lucky. The rest of it's for a false sense of security. And the one-page cheat sheet is in case you get in that point where you lose focus and you go, oh, where am I? And it refocuses you. So I rarely take more than just one page. But I do take all that security blanket with me.
What did the cheat sheet have on it?
It had,
you don't have to tell us the substantive points, but
I have my 90 seconds, at least a sound bite, and then I have the questions I know, because I've worked with client co-counsel and anybody who'll listen, kind of questions that I get, and I kind of have a shorthand way of what's my answer, what's the heart of an answer, so I don't kind of wander too far. Then, of course, you get the questions you weren't expecting, and then you wander all over the place. So,
I think mine was fairly similar. I had the workers' compensation handbook with me in case I needed to go read some specific provision, like 408.027, because we felt on our side of the case so much of this is strictly statutory. It's picking this.